A century and a half later, a community of nations still smoldering from a world war had to lay down a set of principles to unite them in cooperation. It's unlikely that they would have agreed upon, "We accept Jesus Christ as our Savior," or "America is a shining city upon a hill." In 1947, the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, UNESCO, asked several dozen of the world's intellectuals, including Jacques Maritain, Mohandas Gandhi, Aldous Huxley, Harold Lasky, Quincy Wright, and Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, together with eminent Confucian and Muslim scholars, which rights should be included in the UN's Universal Declaration. The lists were surprisingly similar. In his introduction to their deliverable, Maritain recounted, "At one of the meetings of a UNESCO National Commission where human rights were being discussed, someone expressed astonishment that certain champions of violently opposed ideologies had agreed on a list of those rights. 'Yes,' they said, 'we agree about the rights, but on condition that no one asks us why.'" The Universal Declaration of Human Rights, a humanist manifesto with 30 articles, was drafted in less than 2 years, thanks to the determination of Eleanor Roosevelt, chair of the drafting committee, to avoid getting mired in ideology and move the project along. When John Humphrey, author of the first draft, was asked on what principles the declaration was based, he tactfully replied, "No philosophy whatsoever." In December 1948, it was passed without opposition by the UN General Assembly. Contrary to accusations that human rights are a parochial Western creed, the declaration was supported by India, China, Thailand, Burma, Ethiopia, and 7 Muslim countries, while Roosevelt had to twist the arms of American and British officials to get them behind it. The United States was worried about its Negroes, the United Kingdom about its colonies. The Soviet bloc, Saudi Arabia, and South Africa abstained. The declaration has been translated into 500 languages and has influenced most of the national constitutions that were drafted in the following decades, together with many international laws, treaties, and organizations. At 70 years old, it has aged well. Though humanism is the moral code that people will converge upon when they are rational, culturally diverse, and need to get along, it is by no means a vapid or saccharine lowest common denominator. The idea that morality consists in the maximization of human flourishing clashes with two perennially seductive alternatives. The first is theistic morality, the idea that morality consists in obeying the dictates of a deity, which are enforced by supernatural reward and punishment, in this world or in an afterlife. The second is romantic heroism, the idea that morality consists in the purity, authenticity, and greatness of an individual or a nation. Though romantic heroism was first articulated in the 19th century, it may be found in a family of newly influential movements, including authoritarian populism, neo-fascism, neo-reaction, and the alt-right. Many intellectuals who don't sign on to these alternatives to humanism nonetheless believe they capture a vital truth about our psychology, that people have a need for theistic, spiritual, heroic, or tribal beliefs. Humanism may not be wrong, they say, but it goes against human nature. No society based on humanistic principles can long endure, let alone a global order based on them. It's a short step from a psychological claim to a historical one, that the inevitable collapse has begun, and we are watching the liberal, cosmopolitan, enlightenment, humanistic worldview unravel before our eyes. "Liberalism is dead," announced the New York Times columnist Roger Cohen in 2016. "The liberal democratic experiment, with its enlightenment-derived belief in the capacity of individuals possessed of certain inalienable rights to shape their destinies in liberty through the exercise of their will, is but a brief interlude." In The Enlightenment Had a Good Run, the Boston Globe editorialist Stephen Kinzer agreed, "The cosmopolitanism that is central to Enlightenment ideals has produced results that disturb people in many societies. This leads them back toward the ruling system that primates instinctively prefer. A strong chief protects the tribe, and in return, tribe members do the chief's bidding. Reason offers little basis for morality, rejects spiritual power, and negates the importance of emotion, art, and creativity. When reason is cold and inhumane, it can cut people off from deeply embedded structures that give meaning to life. Other pundits have added that it's no wonder so many young people are drawn to ISIS. They are turning away from an arid secularism and seek radical and religious correctives to a flattened view of human life. So, should I have called this book Enlightenment While It Lasts? Don't be silly. In part two, I documented the reality of progress. In this part, I have focused on the ideas that drive it and why I expect them to endure. Having rebutted the cases against reason and science in the preceding two chapters, I'll now take on the case against humanism. I'll examine these arguments not just to show that the moral, psychological, and historical arguments against humanism are wrong. The best way to understand an idea is to see what it is not. So putting the alternatives to humanism under the microscope can remind us what is at stake in advancing the ideals of the Enlightenment. First, we'll look at the religious case against humanism, then at the romantic, heroic, tribal, authoritarian complex. Can we really have good without God? Has the godless universe advanced by humanistic scientists been undermined by the findings of science itself? And is there an innate adaptation to the divine presence, a God gene in our DNA, a God module in the brain, which ensures that theistic religion will always push back against secular humanism? Let's start with theistic morality. It's true that many religious codes enjoin people from murdering, assaulting, robbing, or betraying one another. But of course, so do codes of secular morality, and for an obvious reason. These are rules that all rational, self-interested, and gregarious agents would want their compatriots to agree upon. Not surprisingly, they are codified in the laws of every state, and indeed seem to be present in every human society. What does an appeal to a supernatural lawgiver add to a humanistic commitment to make people better off? The most obvious add-on is supernatural enforcement, the belief that if one commits a sin, one will be smitten by God, damned to hell, or inscribed on the wrong page of the Book of Life. It's a tempting add-on because secular law enforcement cannot possibly detect and punish every infraction, and everyone has a motive to convince everyone else that they cannot get away with murder. As with Santa Claus, he sees you when you're sleeping, he knows when you're awake. He knows if you've been bad or good, so be good for goodness sake. But theistic morality has two fatal flaws. The first is that there is no good reason to believe that God exists. In a non-fiction appendix to her novel 36 Arguments for the Existence of God, a work of fiction, Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein, drawing in part on Plato, Spinoza, Hume, Kant, and Russell, lays out refutations of every one of these arguments. The most common among them, faith, revelation, scripture, authority, tradition, and subjective appeal, are not arguments at all. It's not just that reason says they cannot be trusted. It's also that different religions drawing on these sources decree mutually incompatible beliefs about how many gods there are, which miracles they have wrought, and what they demand of their devotees. Historical scholarship has amply demonstrated that holy scriptures are all too human products of their historical eras, including internal contradictions, factual errors, plagiarism from neighboring civilizations, and scientific absurdities, such as God creating the sun 3 days after he distinguished day from night. The recondite arguments from sophisticated theologians are no sounder. The cosmological and ontological arguments for the existence of God are logically invalid. The argument from design was refuted by Darwin, and the others are either patently false, such as the theory that humans are endowed with an innate faculty for sensing the truth about God, or blatant escape hatches, such as the suggestion that the resurrection was too cosmically important for God to have allowed it to be empirically verified. Some writers insist that science has no place in this conversation. They seek to impose a condition of methodological naturalism on science, which renders it incapable, even in principle, of evaluating the claims of religion. That would carve out a safe space in which believers can protect their beliefs while still being sympathetic to science. But as we saw in the preceding chapter, science is not a game with an arbitrary rule book. It's the application of reason to explaining the universe and to ascertaining whether its explanations are true. In Faith versus Fact, the biologist Jerry Coyne argues that the existence of the God of Scripture is a perfectly testable scientific hypothesis. The Bible's historical accounts could have been corroborated by archaeology, genetics, and philology. It could have contained uncannily prescient scientific truths such as, "Thou shalt not travel faster than light," or, "Two strands entwined is the secret of life." A bright light might appear in the heavens one day, and a man clad in a white robe and sandals, supported by winged angels, could descend from the sky, give sight to the blind, and resurrect the dead. We might discover that intercessory prayer can restore eyesight or regrow amputated limbs, or that anyone who speaks the Prophet Muhammad's name in vain is immediately struck down, while those who pray to Allah 5 times a day are free from disease and misfortune. More generally, the data might show that good things happen to good people, and bad things happen to bad people, that the mothers who die in childbirth, the children who waste away from cancer, and the millions of victims of earthquakes, tsunamis, and holocausts had it coming. Other components of theistic morality, such as the existence of an immaterial soul and a realm of reality beyond matter and energy, are just as testable. We might discover a severed head that can speak. A seer could predict the exact day of natural disasters and terrorist attacks. Aunt Hilda could beam a message from the great beyond, telling us under which floorboard she hid her jewelry. Memoirs from oxygen-starved patients who experienced their souls leaving their bodies could contain verifiable details unavailable to their sense organs. The fact that these reports have all been exposed as tall tales, false memories, overinterpreted coincidences, and cheap carny tricks undermines the hypothesis that there are immaterial souls which could be subject to divine justice. There are, of course, deistic philosophies in which God created the universe and then stepped back to watch what happened, or in which God is merely a synonym for the laws of physics and mathematics. But these impotent gods are in no position to underwrite morality. Many theistic beliefs originated as hypotheses to explain natural phenomena such as the weather, disease, and the origin of species. As these hypotheses have been superseded by scientific ones, the scope of theism has steadily shrunk. But since our scientific understanding is never complete, the pseudo-argument known as the God of the Gaps is always available as a last resort. Today, the more sophisticated theists have tried to place God into two of these gaps, the fundamental physical constants and the hard problem of consciousness. Any humanist who insists that we cannot invoke God to justify morality can expect to be confronted with these gaps, so let me say a few words about each. As we will see, they are likely to go the way of Zeus hurling thunderbolts as an explanation for electrical storms. Our universe can be specified by a few numbers, including the strengths of the forces of nature, gravity, electromagnetism, and the nuclear forces, the number of macroscopic dimensions of space-time, 4, and the density of dark energy, the source of the acceleration of the expansion of the universe. In just 6 numbers, Martin Rees enumerates them on one hand and a finger. The exact tally depends on which version of physical theory one invokes and on whether one counts the constants themselves or ratios between them. If any of these constants were off by a minuscule iota, then matter would fly apart or collapse upon itself, and stars, galaxies, and planets, to say nothing of terrestrial life and Homo sapiens, could never have formed. The best established theories of physics today don't explain why these constants should be so meticulously tuned to values that allowed us to come into being, particularly the density of dark energy. And so, the theistic argument goes, there must have been a fine tuner, namely God. It is the old argument from design applied to the entire cosmos rather than to living things. An immediate objection is the equally old problem of theodicy. If God, in his infinite power and knowledge, fine-tuned the universe to bring us into being, why did he design an earth on which geological and meteorological catastrophes devastate regions inhabited by innocent people? What is the divine purpose of the supervolcanoes that have ravaged our species in the past and may extinguish it in the future, or the evolution of the sun into a red giant that will do so with certainty? But theodical speculation is beside the point. Physicists have not been left dumbstruck by the apparent fine-tuning of the fundamental constants, but are actively pursuing several explanations. One is captured in the title of the physicist Victor Stenger's book, The Fallacy of Fine-Tuning. Many physicists believe that it's premature to conclude that the values of the fundamental constants are either arbitrary or the only ones consistent with life. A deeper understanding of physics, particularly the long-sought unification of relativity and quantum theory, may show that some of the values must be exactly what they are. Others, we might learn, could take on other values, more important, combinations of values that are compatible with a stable, matter-filled universe, albeit not the one we know and love. Progress in physics may reveal that the constants are not so finely tuned, and a life-supporting universe not so improbable after all. The other explanation is that our universe is just one region in a vast, possibly infinite landscape of universes, a multiverse, each with different values of the fundamental constants. We find ourselves in a universe compatible with life not because it was tuned to allow us to exist, but because the very fact that we exist implies that it is that kind of universe, and not one of the vastly more numerous, inhospitable ones that we find ourselves in. Fine-tuning is a fallacy of post-hoc reasoning, like the Megabucks winner who wonders what made him win against all odds. Someone had to win, and it's only because it happened to be him that he's wondering in the first place. It's not the first time that a selection artifact has fooled thinkers into searching for a non-existent deep explanation for a physical constant. Johannes Kepler agonized over why the Earth was 93 million miles away from the sun, just right for water to fill our lakes and rivers without freezing solid or boiling away. Today we know that the Earth is just one of many planets, each at a different distance from our sun or another star, and we are unsurprised to learn that we find ourselves on that planet rather than on Mars. The theory of the multiverse would itself be a post-hoc excuse for an explanation if it were not consistent with other theories in physics. In particular, that the vacuum of space can spawn big bangs which grow into new universes, and that the baby universes can be born with different fundamental constants. Still, the very idea repels many people, not least some physicists, because of its mind-boggling profligacy. An infinity of universes, or at least a number large enough to include all possible arrangements of matter, implies that somewhere there are universes with exact doppelgangers of you, except that they married someone else, were killed by a car last night, are named Evelyn, have one hair out of place, put the audiobook down a moment ago and are not listening to this sentence, and so on. Yet, however unsettling these implications are, the history of ideas tells us that cognitive queasiness is a poor guide to reality. Our best science has repeatedly insulted our ancestors' common sense with unsettling discoveries that turned out to be true, including a round Earth, a slowdown of time at high speeds, quantum superposition, curved space-time, and, of course, evolution. Indeed, once we get over the initial shock, we find that a multiverse is not so exotic after all. This is not even the first time that physicists have had a reason to posit multiple universes. Another version of the multiverse is a straightforward implication of the discoveries that space appears to be infinite and that matter appears to be evenly dispersed through it. There must be an infinity of universes dotting 3D space beyond our cosmic horizon. Still another is the many-worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics, in which the multiple outcomes of a probabilistic quantum process, such as the trajectory of a photon, are all realized in superimposed parallel universes, a possibility that could lead to quantum computers in which all possible values of the variables in a computation are represented simultaneously. Indeed, in one sense, the multiverse is the simpler theory of reality. Since if our universe is the only one in existence, we would need to complicate the elegant laws of physics with an arbitrary stipulation of our universe's parochial initial conditions and its parochial physical constants. As the physicist Max Tegmark, an advocate of four kinds of multiverse, put it, "Our judgment, therefore, comes down to which we find more wasteful and inelegant, many worlds or many words." If the multiverse turns out to be the best explanation of the fundamental physical constants, it would not be the first time we have been flabbergasted by worlds beyond our noses. Our ancestors had to swallow the discovery of the Western Hemisphere, 8 other planets, 100 billion stars in our galaxy, many with planets, and 100 billion galaxies in the observable universe. If reason contradicts intuition once again, so much the worse for intuition. Another advocate of the multiverse, Brian Greene, reminds us, "From a quaint, small, Earth-centered universe to one filled with billions of galaxies, the journey has been both thrilling and humbling. We've been compelled to relinquish sacred belief in our own centrality, but with such cosmic demotion, we've demonstrated the capacity of the human intellect to reach far beyond the confines of ordinary experience to reveal extraordinary truth." The other supposedly God-fillable gap is the hard problem of consciousness, also known as the problem of sentience, subjectivity, phenomenal consciousness, and qualia, the qualitative aspect of consciousness. The term originally suggested by the philosopher David Chalmers is an in-joke because the so-called easy problem, the scientific challenge of distinguishing conscious from unconscious mental computation, identifying its substrates in the brain, and explaining why it evolved, is easy in the sense that curing cancer or sending a man to the moon is easy, namely that it is scientifically tractable. Fortunately, the easy problem is more than just tractable. We are well on the way to a satisfying explanation. It's hardly a mystery why we experience a world of stable, solid, colored 3D objects rather than the kaleidoscope of pixels on our retinas, or why we enjoy and hence seek food, sex, and bodily integrity while suffering from, and hence avoiding, social isolation and tissue damage. These internal states and the behavior they encourage are obvious Darwinian adaptations. With advances in evolutionary psychology, more and more of our conscious experiences are being explained in this way, including our intellectual obsessions, moral emotions, and aesthetic reactions. Nor are the computational and neurobiological bases of consciousness obstinately befuddling. The cognitive neuroscientist Stanislas Duana and his collaborators have argued that consciousness functions as a global workspace or blackboard representation. The blackboard metaphor refers to the way that a diverse set of computational modules can post their results in a common format that all the other modules can see. Those modules include perception, memory, motivation, language, understanding, and action planning, and the fact that they can all access a common pool of currently relevant information, the contents of consciousness, allows us to describe, grasp, or approach what we see, to respond to what other people say or do, and to remember and plan depending on what we want and what we know. The computations inside each module, in contrast, like the calculation of depth from the two eyes or the sequencing of muscle contractions making up an action, can work off their own proprietary input streams, and they proceed below the level of consciousness, having no need for its synoptic view. This global workspace is implemented in the brain as rhythmic, synchronized firing in neural networks that link the prefrontal and parietal cerebral cortexes with each other and with brain areas that feed them perceptual, mnemonic, and motivational signals. The so-called hard problem, why it subjectively feels like something to each one of us who is conscious, with red looking red and salt tasting salty, is hard not because it is a recalcitrant scientific topic, but because it is a head-scratching conceptual enigma. It includes brain teasers such as whether my red is the same as your red, what it is like to be a bat, whether there could be zombies, people indistinguishable from you and me but with no one home, who is feeling anything, and if so, whether everyone but me is a zombie, whether a perfectly lifelike robot would be conscious, whether I could achieve immortality by uploading my brain's connectome to the cloud, and whether the Star Trek transporter really transports Captain Kirk to the planetary surface or murders him and reconstitutes a twin. Some philosophers, like Daniel Dennett in Consciousness Explained, have argued that there is no hard problem of consciousness. It is a confusion arising from the bad habit of imagining a homunculus seated in a theater inside the skull. This is the disembodied experiencer who would temporarily tiptoe out of my theater and drop in on yours to check out the red, or visit the bats and watch the movie that's playing there, who would be missing from the zombie and either present or absent in the robot, and who might or might not survive the beam ride down to Zach Dorn. Sometimes, when I see the mischief that the hard problem has caused, including the conservative intellectual Dinesh D'Souza brandishing a copy of my book, How the Mind Works, in a debate on the existence of God, I am tempted to agree with Dennett that we'd be better off without the term. Contrary to various misunderstandings, the hard problem does not consist in weird physical or paranormal phenomena such as clairvoyance, telepathy, time travel, augury, or action at a distance. It does not call for exotic quantum physics, kitschy energy vibrations, or other New Age flim-flam. Most important for the present discussion, it does not implicate an immaterial soul. Nothing that we know about consciousness is inconsistent with the understanding that it depends entirely on neural activity. In the end, I still think that the hard problem is a meaningful conceptual problem, but agree with Dennett that it is not a meaningful scientific problem. No one will ever get a grant to study whether you are a zombie, or whether the same Captain Kirk walks on the deck of the Enterprise and the surface of Zach Dorn. And I agree with several other philosophers that it may be futile to hope for a solution at all, precisely because it is a conceptual problem, or more accurately, a problem with our concepts. As Thomas Nagel put it in his famous essay, "What is it like to be a bat? There may be facts which could not ever be represented or comprehended by human beings, even if the species lasted forever, simply because our structure does not permit us to operate with concepts of the requisite type." The philosopher Colin McGinn has run with this idea, arguing that there is a mismatch between our cognitive tools for explaining reality, namely chains of causes and effects, analysis into parts and their interactions, and modeling in mathematical equations, and the nature of the hard problem of consciousness, which is intuitively holistic. Our best science tells us that consciousness consists of a global workspace representing our current goals, memories, and surroundings, implemented in synchronized neural firing in frontoparietal circuitry. But the last dollop in the theory, that it subjectively feels like something to be such circuitry, may have to be stipulated as a fact about reality where explanation stops. This should not be entirely surprising. As Ambrose Bierce noted in The Devil's Dictionary, the mind has nothing but itself to know itself with, and it may never feel satisfied that it understands the deepest aspect of its own existence, its intrinsic subjectivity. Whatever we make of the hard problem of consciousness, positing an immaterial soul is of no help at all. For one thing, it tries to solve a mystery with an even bigger mystery. For another, it falsely predicts the existence of paranormal phenomena. Most damningly, a divinely granted consciousness does not meet the design specs for a locus of just deserts. Why would God have endowed a mobster with the ability to enjoy his ill-gotten gains, or a sexual predator with carnal pleasure? If it's to plant temptations for them to prove their morality by resisting, Why should their victims be collateral damage? Why would a merciful God be dissatisfied with robbing years of life from a cancer patient and add the gratuitous punishment of agonizing pain? Like the phenomena of physics, the phenomena of consciousness look exactly as you would expect if the laws of nature applied without regard to human welfare. If we want to enhance that welfare, we have to figure out how to do it ourselves. And that brings us to the second problem with theistic morality. It's not just that there is almost certainly no God to dictate and enforce moral precepts. It's that even if there were a God, His divine decrees, as conveyed to us through religion, cannot be the source of morality. The explanation goes back to Plato's Euthyphro, in which Socrates points out that if the gods have good reasons to deem certain acts moral, we can appeal to those reasons directly, skipping the middlemen. If they don't, we should not take their dictates seriously. After all, thoughtful people can give reasons why they don't kill, rape, or torture other than fear of eternal hellfire, and they would not suddenly become rapists and contract killers if they had reason to believe that God's back was turned, or if he told them it was okay. Theistic moralists reply that the God of Scripture, unlike the capricious deities of Greek mythology, is by his very nature incapable of issuing immoral commandments. But anyone who is familiar with Scripture knows that this is not so. The God of the Old Testament murdered innocents by the millions, commanded the Israelites to commit mass rape and genocide, and prescribed the death penalty for blasphemy, idolatry, homosexuality, adultery, talking back to parents, and working on the Sabbath, while finding nothing particularly wrong with slavery, rape, torture, mutilation, and genocide. All this was par for the course for Bronze and Iron Age civilizations. Today, of course, enlightened believers cherry-pick the humane injunctions while allegorizing, spin-doctoring, or ignoring the vicious ones, and that's just the point. They read the Bible through the lens of Enlightenment humanism. The Euthyphro argument puts the lie to the common claim that atheism consigns us to a moral relativism in which everyone can do his own thing. The claim gets it backwards. A humanistic morality rests on the universal bedrock of reason and human interests. It's an inescapable feature of the human condition that we're all better off if we help each other and refrain from hurting each other. For this reason, many contemporary philosophers, including Nagel, Goldstein, Peter Singer, Peter Railton, Richard Boyd, David Brink, and Derek Parfit, are moral realists, the opposite of relativists, arguing that moral statements may be objectively true or false. It's religion that is inherently relativistic. Given the absence of evidence, any belief in how many deities there are, who are their earthly prophets and messiahs, and what they demand of us, can depend only on the parochial dogmas of one's tribe. Not only does this make theistic morality relativistic, it can make it immoral. Invisible gods can command people to slay heretics, infidels, and apostates, and an immaterial soul is unmoved by the earthly incentives that impel us to get along. Contestants over a material resource are usually better off if they split it than fight over it, particularly if they value their own lives on earth. But contestants over a sacred value, like holy land or affirmation of a belief, may not compromise. And if they think their souls are immortal, the loss of their body is no big deal. Indeed, it may be a small price to pay for an eternal reward in paradise. Many historians have pointed out that religious wars are long and bloody wars are often prolonged by religious conviction. Matthew White, the necrometrician we met in Chapter 14, lists 30 religious conflicts among the worst things that people have ever done to one another, resulting in around 55 million killings. In 17 conflicts, the monotheistic religions fought each other. In another 8, monotheists fought heathens. And the common assertion that the two world wars were set off by the decline of religious morality, as in the former Trump strategist Stephen Bannon's recent claim that World War II pitted the Judeo-Christian West versus atheists, is dunce cap history. The belligerents on both sides of World War I were devoutly Christian, except for the Ottoman Empire, a Muslim theocracy. The only avowedly atheist power that fought in World War II was the Soviet Union, and for most of the war it fought on our side against the Nazi regime, which, contrary to another myth, was sympathetic to German Christianity and vice versa. The two factions united in their loathing of secular modernity. Hitler himself was a deist who said, "I am convinced that I am acting as the agent of our Creator. By fighting off the Jews, I am doing the Lord's work." Defenders of theism retort that irreligious wars and atrocities, motivated by the secular ideology of communism and by ordinary conquest, have killed even more people. Talk about relativism. It is peculiar to grade religion on this curve. If religion were a source of morality, the number of religious wars and atrocities ought to be zero. And obviously, atheism is not a moral system in the first place. It's just the absence of supernatural belief, like an unwillingness to believe in Zeus or Vishnu. The moral alternative to theism is humanism. Few sophisticated people today profess a belief in heaven and hell, the literal truth of the Bible, or a God who flouts the laws of physics. But many intellectuals have reacted with fury to the new atheism, popularized in a quartet of bestsellers published between 2004 and 2007 by Sam Harris, Richard Dawkins, Daniel Dennett, and Christopher Hitchens. Their reaction has been called, "I'm an atheist, but belief in belief, accommodationism, and in coin's coinage, faithism." It overlaps with the hostility to science within the second culture, presumably because of a shared sympathy to hermeneutic over analytical and empirical methodologies, and a reluctance to acknowledge that dweeby scientists and secular philosophers might be right about the fundamental questions of existence. Though atheism, the absence of a belief in God, is compatible with a wide range of humanistic and anti-humanistic beliefs, the new atheists are avowedly humanistic. So any flaws in their worldview might carry over to humanism more generally. According to the faithists, the new atheists are too shrill and militant and just as annoying as the fundamentalists they criticize. In her next KCD webcomic, a character responds, "Well, the important thing is that you've found a way to feel superior to both." Ordinary people will never be disabused of their religious beliefs, they say, and perhaps they should not be. Because healthy societies need religion as a bulwark against selfishness and meaningless consumerism. Religious institutions supply that need by promoting charity, community, social responsibility, rites of passage, and guidance on existential questions that can never be provided by science. Anyway, most people treat religious doctrine allegorically rather than literally, and they find meaning and wisdom in an overarching sense of spirituality, grace, and divine order. Let's look at these claims. An ironic inspiration for faithism is research on the psychological origins of supernatural belief, including the cognitive habits of over-attributing design and agency to natural phenomena, and emotional feelings of solidarity within communities of faith. The most natural interpretation of these findings is that they undermine religious beliefs by showing how they are figments of our neurobiological makeup. But the research has also been interpreted as showing that human nature requires religion in the same way that it requires food, sex, and companionship. So it's futile to imagine no religion. But this interpretation is dubious. Not every feature of human nature is a homeostatic drive that must be regularly slaked. Yes, people are vulnerable to cognitive illusions that lead to supernatural beliefs, and they certainly need to belong to a community. Over the course of history, institutions have arisen that offer packages of customs that encourage those illusions and cater to those needs. That does not imply that people need the complete packages, any more than the existence of sexual desire implies that people need Playboy clubs. As societies become more educated and secure, the components of the legacy religious institutions can be unbundled. The art, rituals, iconography, and communal warmth that many people enjoy can continue to be provided by liberalized religions without the supernatural dogma or Iron Age morality. That implies that religions should not be condemned or praised across the board, but considered according to the logic of Euthyphro. If there are justifiable reasons behind particular activities, those activities should be encouraged, but the movements should not be given a pass just because they are religious. Among the positive contributions of religions at particular times and places are education, charity, medical care, counseling, conflict resolution, and other social services, though in the developed world these efforts are dwarfed by their secular counterparts. No religion could have decimated hunger, disease, illiteracy, war, homicide, or poverty on the scales we saw in Part 2. Religious organizations can also provide a sense of communal solidarity and mutual support, together with art, ritual, and architecture of great beauty and historical resonance, thanks to their millennia-long head start. I partake of these myself with much enjoyment. If the positive contributions of religious institutions come from their role as humanistic associations in civil society, then we would expect those benefits not to be tied to theistic belief. And that is indeed the case. It's long been known that churchgoers are happier and more charitable than stay-at-homes. But Robert Putnam and his fellow political scientist David Campbell have found that these blessings have nothing to do with beliefs in God, creation, heaven, or hell. An atheist who has been pulled into a congregation by an observant spouse is as charitable as the faithful among the flock, whereas a fervent believer who prays alone is not particularly charitable. At the same time, communality and civic virtue can be fostered by membership in secular service communities, such as the Shriners with their children's hospitals and burn units, Rotary International, which is helping to end polio, and Lions Club, which combats blindness. Even, according to Putnam and Campbell's research, a bowling league. Just as religious institutions deserve praise when they pursue humanistic ends, they should not be shielded from criticism when they obstruct those ends. Examples include the withholding of medical care from sick children in faith-healing sects, the opposition to humane assisted dying, the corruption of science education in schools, the suppression of touchy biomedical research such as on stem cells, and obstruction of life-saving public health policies such as contraception, condoms, and vaccination against HPV. Nor should religions be granted a presumption of a higher moral purpose. Faithists who have hoped that the moralistic fervor of evangelical Christianity might be channeled into movements for social improvement have repeatedly gotten burned. In the early 2000s, a bipartisan coalition of environmentalists hoped to make common cause with evangelicals on climate change under rubrics like creation care and faith-based environmentalism. But evangelical churches are an anchor faction of the Republican Party, which adopted a strategy of absolute non-cooperation with the Obama administration. Political tribalism carried the day, and the evangelicals fell into line, opting for radical libertarianism over stewardship of the creation. Similarly, in 2016, there was a brief hope that the Christian virtues of humility, temperance, forgiveness, propriety, chivalry, thrift, and compassion toward the weak would turn evangelicals against a casino developer who was vainglorious, sybaritic, vindictive, lewd, misogynistic, ostentatiously wealthy, and contemptuous of the people he called losers. But no. Donald Trump won the votes of 81% of white evangelical and born-again Christians, a higher proportion than of any other demographic. In large part, he earned their votes by promising to repeal a law which prohibits tax-exempt charities, including churches, from engaging in political activism. Christian virtue was trumped by political muscle. If the factual tenets of religion can no longer be taken seriously, and its ethical tenets depend entirely on whether they can be justified by secular morality, what about its claims to wisdom on the great questions of existence? A favorite talking point of faithists is that only religion can speak to the deepest yearnings of the human heart. Science will never be adequate to address the great existential questions of life, death, love, loneliness, loss, honor, cosmic justice, and metaphysical hope. This is the kind of statement that Dennett, quoting a young child, calls adipity. It has a patina of profundity, but as soon as one thinks about what it means, it turns out to be nonsense. To begin with, the alternative to religion as a source of meaning is not science. No one ever suggested that we look to ichthyology or nephrology for enlightenment on how to live, but rather to the entire fabric of human knowledge, reason, and humanistic values, of which science is a part. It's true that the fabric contains important strands that originated in religion, such as the language and allegories of the Bible and the writings of sages, scholars, and rabbis. But today it is dominated by secular content, including debates on ethics originating in Greek and Enlightenment philosophy, and renderings of love, loss, and loneliness in the works of Shakespeare, the Romantic poets, the 19th-century novelists, and other great artists and essayists. Judged by universal standards, many of the religious contributions to life's great questions turn out to be not deep and timeless, but shallow and archaic, such as a conception of justice that includes punishing blasphemers, or a conception of love that adjures a woman to obey her husband. As we have seen, any conception of life and death that depends on the existence of an immaterial soul is factually dubious and morally dangerous. And since cosmic justice and metaphysical hope, as opposed to human justice and worldly hope, do not exist, then it's not meaningful to seek them. It's pointless. The claim that people should seek deeper meaning in supernatural beliefs has little to recommend it. What about a more abstract sense of spirituality? If it consists in gratitude for one's existence, awe at the beauty and immensity of the universe, and humility before the frontiers of human understanding, then spirituality is indeed an experience that makes life worth living, and one that is lifted into higher dimensions by the revelations of science and philosophy. But spirituality is often taken to mean something more, the conviction that the universe is somehow personal, that everything happens for a reason, that meaning is to be found in the happenstances of life. In the final episode of her landmark show, Oprah Winfrey spoke for millions when she avowed, "I understand the manifestation of grace and God, so I know there are no coincidences. There are none. Only divine order here." This sense of spirituality is considered in a video sketch by the comedian Amy Schumer called The Universe. It opens with the science popularizer Bill Nye standing against a backdrop of stars and galaxies. Nye. The universe. For centuries, humankind has strived to understand this vast expanse of energy, gas, and dust. In recent years, a stunning breakthrough has been made in our concept of what the universe is for. Zoom to the Earth's surface, and then to a yogurt shop in which two young women are chatting. First woman. "So, I was texting while I was driving, and I ended up taking a wrong turn that took me directly past a vitamin shop, and I was just like, this is totally the universe telling me I should be taking calcium." Nye. "Scientists once believed the universe was a chaotic collection of matter. We now know the universe is essentially a force sending cosmic guidance to women in their 20s. Zoom to a gym with Schumer and a friend on exercycles. Schumer. "So, you know how I've been fucking my married boss for like 6 months? Well, I was starting to get really worried he was never going to leave his wife, but then yesterday, in yoga, the girl in front of me was wearing a shirt that just said, 'Chill.' And I was just like, this is so the universe telling me, girl, just like, keep fucking your married boss." A spirituality that sees cosmic meaning in the whims of fortune is not wise but foolish. The first step toward wisdom is the realization that the laws of the universe don't care about you. The next is the realization that this does not imply that life is meaningless, because people care about you and vice versa. You care about yourself, and you have a responsibility to respect the laws of the universe that keep you alive, so you don't squander your existence. Your loved ones care about you, and you have a responsibility not to orphan your children, widow your spouse, and shatter your parents. And anyone with a humanistic sensibility cares about you, not in the sense of feeling your pain. Human empathy is too feeble to spread itself across billions of strangers, but in the sense of realizing that your existence is cosmically no less important than theirs, and that we all have a responsibility to use the laws of the universe to enhance the conditions in which we all can flourish. Arguments aside, is the need to believe pushing back against secular humanism? Believers, faithists, and resenters of science and progress are gloating about an apparent return of religion all over the world. But as we shall see, the rebound is an illusion. The world's fastest-growing religion is no religion at all. Measuring the history of religious belief is not easy. Few surveys have asked people the same questions in different times and places, and the respondents would interpret them differently even if they did. Many people are queasy about labeling themselves atheist, a word they equate with amoral and which can expose them to hostility, discrimination, and, in many Muslim countries, imprisonment, mutilation, or death. Also, most people are hazy theologians and may stop short of declaring themselves atheists while admitting that they have no religion or religious beliefs, find religion unimportant, are spiritual but not religious, or believe in some higher power, which is not God. Different surveys can end up with different estimates of irreligion, depending on how the alternatives are worded. We can't say for sure how many non-believers there were in earlier decades and centuries, but there can't have been many. One estimate put the proportion in 1900 at 0.2%. According to Wynn Gallup International's Global Index of Religiosity and Atheism, a survey of 50,000 people in 57 countries, 13% of the world's population identified themselves as a convinced atheist in 2012, up from around 10% in 2005. It would not be fanciful to say that over the course of the 20th century, the global rate of atheism increased by a factor of 500, and that it has doubled again so far in the 21st. An additional 23% of the world's population identify themselves as not a religious person, leaving 59% of the world as religious, down from close to 100% a century before. According to an old idea in social science called the secularization thesis, irreligion is a natural consequence of affluence and education. Recent studies confirm that wealthier and better educated countries tend to be less religious. The decline is clearest in the developed countries of Western Europe, the Commonwealth, and East Asia. In Australia, Canada, France, Hong Kong, Ireland, Japan, the Netherlands, Sweden, and several other countries, religious people are in the minority, and atheists make up a quarter to more than half of the population. Religion has also declined in formerly communist countries, especially China, though not in Latin America, the Islamic world, or sub-Saharan Africa. The data show no signs of a global religious revival. Among the 39 countries surveyed by the index in both 2005 and 2012, only 11 became more religious, none by more than 6 percentage points, while 26 became less religious, many by double digits. And contrary to impressions from the news, the religiously excitable countries of Poland, Russia, Bosnia, Turkey, India, Nigeria, and Kenya became less religious over these 7 years, as did the United States. More on this soon. Overall, the percentage of people who called themselves religious declined by 9 points, making room for growth in the proportion of convinced atheists in a majority of the countries. Another global survey by the Pew Research Center tried to project religious affiliation into the future. The survey did not ask about belief. The survey found that in 2010, a sixth of the world's population, when asked to name their religion, chose none. There are more nuns in the world than Hindus, Buddhists, Jews, or devotees of folk religions, And this is the denomination that the largest number of people are expected to switch into. By 2050, 61.5 million more people will have lost their religion than found one. With all these numbers showing that people are becoming less religious, where did the idea of a religious revival come from? It comes from what Quebecers call la revanche du berceau, the revenge of the cradle. Religious people have more babies. The demographers at Pew did the math and projected that the proportion of the world's population that is Muslim might rise from 23.2% in 2010 to 29.7% in 2050, while the percentage of Christians will remain unchanged, and the percentage of all other denominations, together with the religiously unaffiliated, will decrease. Even this projection is a hostage to current fertility estimates and may become obsolete if Africa, religious and fecund, undergoes the demographic transition, or if the Muslim fertility decline, discussed in Chapter 10, continues. A key question about the secularization trend is whether it is being driven by changing times, a period effect, a graying population, an age effect, or the turnover of generations, a cohort effect. Only a few countries, all English-speaking, have the multi-decade data we need to answer the question. Australians, New Zealanders, and Canadians have become less religious as the years have gone by, probably because of changing times, rather than the population getting older. If anything, we would expect people to become more religious as they prepare to meet their maker. There was no such change in the British or American zeitgeist, but in all five countries, each generation was less religious than the one before. The cohort effect is substantial. More than 80% of the British GI generation, born 1905 to 1924, said they belonged to a religion. But at the same ages, fewer than 30% of the millennials did. More than 70% of the American GI generation said they know God exists, but only 40% of their millennial great-grandchildren say that. The discovery of a generational turnover throughout the Anglosphere removes a big thorn in the side of the secularization thesis, the United States, which is wealthy but religious. As early as 1840, Alexis de Tocqueville remarked on how Americans were more devout than their European cousins, and the difference persists today. In 2012, 60% of Americans called themselves religious, compared with 46% of Canadians, 37% of the French, and 29% of Swedes. Other Western democracies have 2 to 6 times the proportion of atheists found in the United States. But while Americans started from a higher level of belief, they have not escaped the march of secularization from one generation to the next. A recent report summarizes the trend in its title, Exodus: Why Americans Are Leaving Religion and Why They're Unlikely to Come Back. The exodus is most visible in the rise of the nuns, from 5% in 1972 to 25% today, making them the largest religious group in the United States, surpassing Catholics, 21%, white evangelicals, 16%, and white mainline Protestants, 13.5%. The cohort gradient is steep. Just 13% of silents and older boomers are nuns, compared with 39% of millennials. The younger generations, moreover, are more likely to remain irreligious as they age and stare down their mortality. The trends are just as dramatic among the subset of nuns, who are not just none of the abovers, but confessed non-believers. The percentage of Americans who say they are atheist or agnostic, or that religion is unimportant to them, probably no more than a percentage point or two in the 1950s, rose to 10.3% in 2007 and 15.8% in 2014. The cohorts break down like this: 7% of silents, 11% of boomers, 25% of millennials. Clever survey techniques designed to get around people's squeamishness in confessing to atheism suggest that the true percentages are even higher. Why, then, do commentators think that religion is rebounding in the United States? It's because of yet another finding about the American exodus. Nuns don't vote. In 2012, religiously unaffiliated Americans made up 20% of the populace, but 12% of the voters. Organized religions, by definition, are organized, and they have been putting that organization to work in getting out the vote and directing it their way. In 2012, white evangelical Protestants also made up 20% of the adult population, but they made up 26% of the voters.